Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, highlighting the flavors of fall with pumpkin spice in everything from bakery treats to favorite drinks. All things pumpkin spice are available at local Harmon's stores. harmonsgrocery.com.
On Tuesday, The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints announced Dallin H. Oaks as the next president of the church. The succession plan is straightforward, so this wasn't a surprise. Now, he doesn't know this for sure, but the historian Benjamin Park told us this week he believes Dallin Oaks may see himself as having been prepared for this moment, that his entire career has led to this point in American history where social and political polarization has been chaotic and violent, and that what the country and maybe the church needs right now is someone who can restore a sense of order. Now, the reason Park believes this is because he says there's an origin story for how Dallin Oaks came to see the world.
The United States has had a number of cataclysmic years, but few years were as consequential in America as 1968.
I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
Lyndon Johnson announced that he would not be seeking re-election. Richard Nixon was running on a law and order campaign.
We look at America, we see cities enveloped in smoke and flame.
Martin Luther King Jr. was killed.
Police, who have been keeping a close watch over the Nobel Peace Prize winner because of Memphis' turbulent racial situation, were on the scene almost immediately.
And there was a rise of anti-Vietnam rhetoric. In general, it seemed like the United States was on fire. In the midst of all that crisis, the Democratic National Convention took place in Chicago, Illinois. And that convention showed all the fissures that were dividing all of America.
Thousands of young people are being beaten in the streets of Chicago.
There was infighting on the stage.
Wisconsin is not recognized for that purpose.
Protests outside. The cops had to be called in to quell what they saw as an insurrection. And among those who had a firsthand view of all this crisis was Dallin H. Oaks. He had been at the University of Chicago Law School for about a decade by that point. He had also just been appointed to a university committee that would oversee all the disciplinary hearings for the students who had been arrested for protesting, for picketing, and at one point even taking over the university administrative office. Oaks saw this as a threat to American stability, that the nation no longer properly respected law and order. And we know this because that very year, he contributed an essay to the liberal journal Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, and their roundtable on the civil rights protest. His essay, titled Law and Order, a Two-Way Street, kicked off by saying that America has a toxic lack of respect for law and order, and that for society to function, there has to be structure, rules, precedents, and boundaries that were clearly marked. That essay that appeared in a liberal Mormon journal captured many of the themes that would dominate Dallin H. Oaks' career, first when he goes to Brigham Young University as president, then when he serves on the Utah Supreme Court, and then when he is called as an apostle. At every point, he is instituting what he sees as necessary guardrails, boundaries, the laws that are going to order society and make sure everyone is able to exist in a safe, comfortable, and orderly space. I think ever since then, and now we're coming up on 60 years since that moment, Dallin Oaks has been framed by that year in which he saw that without those rules, without that order, everything would devolve into chaos. I imagine that he sees that he's been groomed for this moment, that he thinks his entire career has been pointing to this time in which he would take the helm of God's kingdom on earth at a period when the nation is once again teetering on chaos, where once again there is a rise in political violence, where once again there seems to be both sides of the political divide clamoring for radical change. And he, as the consummate institutionalist and in his mind the moderate, is able to reach out and say, stop. We need to slow down. We need to recognize what will actually bring the stability that we so desire. And that stability can only be seen through a much more orderly approach, a systematic demeanor, and a respect for precedent that he likely feels is no longer being prioritized. I think he looks out at society, sees that there is great progress, but there's also a constant threat that if we do not have the guardrails in place, if we do not have the watchmen in their position to give warnings, then we are always one generation away from losing it all.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Dallin H. Oakes, what we know about his personal, professional, and spiritual life, and how all of that shaped him into the new president of the LDS Church. Benjamin Park is with us for the hour to walk us through it. Park is an associate professor of history at Sam Houston State University in Texas. And let's start with the announcement on Tuesday.
We welcome you from the Conference Center in Salt Lake City, Utah, on this memorable occasion of the presentation of a new first presidency.
This was a scripted presentation, not a news conference. Reporters weren't invited, as they have been in the past. President Oakes ran it like a church service. We heard from the new first presidency, the counselors he's chosen, Henry B. Eyring as first counselor, Apostle D. Todd Christofferson as second counselor, Jeffrey Holland, the senior member of the 12 apostles. He spoke briefly. They all spoke briefly, even Oakes.
I accept with humility the responsibility that God has placed upon me and commit my whole heart and soul to the service to which I've been called. I'm grateful to President Eyring and to...
We asked Benjamin Park what he made of the announcement and this first glimpse of the Oakes administration.
I go back and read the reports of when Gordon B. Hinckley became the LDS president in 1995, and they held what was expected to be a short announcement like they had for Howard W. Hunter and Ezra F. Benson and Spencer W. Kimball before that, where they just kind of make the announcement and leave the stage. And Gordon B. Hinckley then says, are there any questions? And the journalists were flummoxed. They're like, wait, you're opening this up to questions?
Yeah.
And that set a precedent that others had followed. And so now some journalists have come to expect that. And further, I think we've also been coached to where with Russell M. Nelson, he was a man for the scene. He was a man of the moment. He liked the pageantry. He liked creating the scene. And so you saw it, his opening press conference. I think that went over an hour. I remember that time because I had to go out and splice out portions of it to teach. And it was hard because there's so much there. Dallin H. Oakes is a different president. Yeah. He has a different background. He has a different persona. This is in many ways an opening statement of a legal brief rather than, you know, the opening media circus that you might have seen with previous presidents. So you see him setting the tone of how he might be different than his predecessor, at least in approach.
How much consideration does a new church president give to the administration that came before? Because Oak said something at that announcement on Tuesday that I found interesting. He acknowledged President Nelson. Now, that didn't seem different. That made sense, of course. But then he said, there is much work to do to fulfill the challenges President Nelson has given us. And it made me wonder, does that mean that he's not just going to, you know, scrap Nelson's agenda and craft his own direction? Or, like, what did you make of that, if you did?
I think there's a few things going on. First, Most LDS presidents are very keen on respecting, reverencing, and building on their predecessors because they recognize that they are part of what they see as an unbroken chain going back to Joseph Smith. And so they are part, and so they don't want to break with that president because if you break with those before you, people might break with you in the future. And on top of that, Dallin H. Oaks, as a legal mind and a judicial theorist, he is one who's very much about precedent. He wants tradition. I think he wants stability. And so if Russell M. Nelson was one who is seen more as a visionary, Dallin H. Oaks is one who is more of an administrator. Mm-hmm. And so he might feel in general that enough changes came about with Russell M. Nelson in the last 8 years to where we still need to fulfill that. But further, I think by personal demeanor, Dallin H. Oaks is not one for major changes. I think he wants to cement. And so it might work out with their personality wise that he was able to work with someone who initiated all the fundamental changes that he now gets to oversee and expand.
Then there's the argument that he was so involved in the changes with President Nelson's administration that he doesn't really need to forge a new path because he helped craft the old path.
Yeah, I think you can take diverging perspectives on how these prophets approached changes in various eras. You can see Russell M. Nelson on the one hand, maybe he's fulfilling what he feels the church had been moving toward for a while, or an alternate approach is that Russell M. Nelson felt that the reforms he wanted to implement had not been adopted, and now he had the chance. And that's why there are so many changes in such a short amount of time. With Dallin H. Oaks, there's always a chance that maybe he secretly didn't like or didn't agree with a lot of those changes, or maybe he wants a lot of changes that Nelson had been pushed back. But in general, when I think about, is Dallin H. Oaks going to introduce a number of track redirections?
Right.
I don't think so, because I think Latter-day Saints are already existing in the church that Dallin H. Oaks built. I think few apostles have been as consequential in the last 41 years as Dallin H. Oaks, whose fingerprints are on top of nearly every administration during this time, and their policies and their rhetoric and their approach. So in many ways, I see this as a culmination rather than a shift of what's already happened.
What do we know about Dallin Oaks' upbringing, his, you know, his childhood? Like, was he raised, I don't know, I'll put it this way, conventionally Mormon, in a conventionally Mormon household?
He was raised conventionally Mormon in the way that he lived in Provo, Utah, for a large segment, which you can't get much more conventionally Mormon than that.
Right.
And unlike Nelson, he was raised in a very active and believing home. The one difference is his father died when he was at a rather young age, so he was raised with a single mother. On the one hand, you might think that that opens his eyes to the diverse family structures that exist in the world today. On the other, it might lead to him doubling down on trying to reaffirm traditional gender roles and family structures that he himself had lacked. I think of a talk he gave a number of years ago where he, as a youth, was going out with a priesthood leader to deliver gifts to all the families in their ward that did not have a father at home. So all the single mother homes that in their estimation is probably lacking gifts. And so we're going to, you know, make up for it and bring those gifts. And the last home they stopped by was Oaks's own home. And he said that was the very first time that he ever considered that he was coming from an unorthodox family in the sense of the family structure. So I think on the one hand, he does have an experience that is very much like many Latter-day Saints, because it does not fit the ideal parameters of a family. But he himself has always understood his background and history as something well within the Latter-day Saint fold.
You described Russell Nelson as the first post-pioneer prophet of the church. Maybe say what you mean by that, and then tell us where Dallin Oaks fits in terms of, I guess, his generational relationship with his church.
Yeah, I called Nelson the first post-pioneer prophet because he was much more willing than his president predecessors to give up some of the cultural expressions and luggage that came with the Latter-day Saint tradition, whether it be the pageants, whether it be the Mormon name, whether it be the traditional way they did this or that, or the worship services, and that he represented trying to modernize the church a bit more than those who came before, admittedly a number like Gordon Hinckley or David O. McKay, who were modernizers. Yeah. Where Dallin H. Oakes fits in that, I think, is very on the same wavelength, in the sense that Nelson and Oakes were called to the apostleship at the same general conference in April of 1984. They're of the same generation. They were raised in a faith that mostly took their American assimilation for granted, that were sensitive to when evangelicals would denounce Mormons as cults, because they were like, no, we're proud Christians just like everyone else, who are, you know, a generation removed from those who were much more committed to the pioneer image rather than the Christian identity. So I think Dallin H. Oakes is just going to cement the direction that Russell M. Nelson had already introduced of seeing Mormonism not as a unique division from or diversion from Christianity, but rather a unique expression within Christianity.
What do you understand about Dallin Oakes' ambition for what he wanted younger? It seems like it would probably have been related to the law. You know, there was a lot of speculation for a time, this was a few years ago, that maybe even Dallin Oakes might have been disappointed to get the assignment to become an apostle of the church because he had pegged his hopes on being a U.S. Supreme Court justice. Certainly he was a state Supreme Court justice, but he had higher ambitions in that realm. Can you say anything at all about any of that?
Yeah, so I'm not sure if he saw his apostolic calling as a step down for what could have been. He certainly was a finalist for Supreme Court cases when Ronald Reagan was choosing a Supreme Court justice in the early 1980s. Dallin H. Oakes was on the shortlist. Dallin H. Oakes served as the general chair for the National PBS Broadcasting Service. I mean, he was a national name, and that reflected some desires from very early on. Even though raised by a single mother in Provo, he went on to law school at the University of Chicago, one of the best law schools in the nation. Then he clerked for Supreme Court Justice Earl Warren. That's not a typical path for people coming out of Provo, Utah. So he clearly had a lot of intelligence. He clearly had a lot of aspirations. And so I think he always had a desire to help shape things, that he knew he was going to be a man of consequence, even if at most points, my read on him is he kind of shied away from the spotlight itself. He wanted to be part of the influential institutions. He didn't want to be the influential celebrity himself. He will also often hide behind committees and boards and quorums. He'd rather speak as a group. I don't think he's as comfortable as, say, Russell Nelson was of being the figurehead of God's chosen priesthood. I think he would rather be seen as part of God's chosen kingdom.
This was something that surprised me. You mentioned in that story at the beginning of the show that he wrote a piece for Dialogue. But you said that he was part of a Latter-day Saint intellectual tradition. And I wanted you to say a little bit more about that. Where did he fit in that way?
Yeah, Oakes was good friends with a lot of the major historians and theologians and thinkers of the Mormon intelligentsia in the 1960s. He wrote essays with them. He would eventually co-author a book on Joseph Smith's death at Carthage Jail, a book titled Carthage Conspiracy and published by University of Illinois Press that won the Mormon History Association's Best Book Award in the 1970s. He was someone who believed that we could think through these matters. But then it also seems like he took a hard turn when he feared that the protests and these discussions and these dialogues were going too far and leading into anarchy and chaos, instead buying into the church's argument that we need a correlated message. We need to speak as a unit. We don't want to emphasize our diversity. We want to emphasize our strength. So Dallin H. Oakes not only wrote an essay for Dialogue, he was originally on their editorial board, but then he resigned from that editorial board within a few years, in part because his intellectual desires were leading in a different way than what the church's institutional priorities were.
What do you mean?
I think he ended up agreeing with the church's positions that these ideological debates were doing more harm than good, that we need to place these boundaries, which is why he ends up delivering a very influential LDS address in the midst of the late 1980s, early 1990s fights with intellectuals, an address titled Alternative Voices, in which he says that those groups that are speaking outside, without the church impromptu, who are not reflecting the church's primary interests, should not be listened to. He even delivered an address in 1987 in which he said that it is not right for members of the church to criticize the brethren, even if the criticisms are true. And by that, he meant if you are speaking from within that tradition, representing that institution, speaking on behalf rather than as an independent scholar, but speaking as a BYU professor or a church historian, you need to get in line. And he likened it to a lawyer who might know a lot more about their client than they are willing to say in court, because not all that information is useful for that case. So too, he argued, if you are writing for the church, on behalf of the church, from the church's perspective, you need to be saying things that fit the church's prioritized mission.
Let's underline what he said there. He said that it's not proper, it's not right to criticize leaders of the church, even if the leaders of the church are not right?
Yeah, so the wording was, criticism of the brethren is wrong, even when that criticism is true. Now, that was a statement that he gave in the midst of these history battles in the late 1980s, early 1990s, that then he's asked about and he repeats on the famous The Mormons documentary by Helen Whitney in 2007 that was broadcast on PBS. So that's a soundbite that a lot of people will hear, that criticism of the brethren is wrong, even when that criticism is true. He's quoting that address that he gave back then. I imagine he's actually softened on some of those positions. A lot of debate got heated back then at the culminating, of course, in the September 6th, when six LDS intellectuals were disciplined, five of them excommunicated, and Oakes's words were, you know, reflective of that period. And since then, he has, you know, supported things like the church's Joseph Smith Papers Project, the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Even in that PBS documentary, he praised the wonderful book by Kathleen Flake, The Politics of American Religious Identity, as a model of true scholarship. And there's plenty of in that book that can be deemed as criticism of what, you know, church leaders were doing in the early 1900s. But I do think that he probably still feels that the institution itself, that if you are attached to the institution, speaking on behalf of the institution, or writing from that institution's perspective, you need to emphasize that institution's prioritized message and not show any diversity or schisms.
It seems like a mixed message.
Yeah, I think it's a paradox that all of us might hold in our heart of what our true allegiance is to the institution or the truth. Now, of course, Oakes would say that there's no division between that because the church has a true message and we're going to follow that true message. But I do think it causes, you know, a lot of heartache for those who are trying to write within the LDS church, writing historical topics, theological topics, sociological topics, writing on homosexuality and on gender, recognizing that if they do not write in a way that proves their faithfulness and their allegiance, that they can be cast as these alternative voices that he had denounced.
That's Benjamin Park. He's an associate professor of history at Sam Houston State University, also author of the book American Zion, A New History of Mormonism. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, highlighting the flavors of fall with pumpkin spice in everything from bakery treats to favorite drinks. All things pumpkin spice are available at local Harmon's stores. Harmon'sGrocery.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the new president of the LDS Church. It's Dallin Oakes. And this wasn't a surprise, the announcement that came earlier this week. The church succession plan is pretty cut and dried, though there is a new counselor in the governing first presidency, which we'll talk about. As for Oakes, he's a former Utah Supreme Court justice known for his conservative views on religious freedom, on the structure of the family and gender and sexuality. Throughout his ministry, Oakes has urged Latter-day Saints to push back against these broader cultural trends, like fewer marriages and declining birth rates. If the previous president, Russell Nelson, was about change and momentum, observers say Oakes might be about steadiness and focus, fewer grand global initiatives, a kind of slower pace. We have with us today the historian and religion scholar Benjamin Park. Let's talk about some of the issues that have been important to Dallin Oakes over his life as an apostle and even as a lawyer or a legal scholar. Religious liberty seems to come to the top. What do you understand about his defense of religious liberty? Why has that been so important to him? And maybe explain what he means by religious liberty and the concern that he has over it.
That's a good question, because his definition of religious liberty has evolved in the past 50 years in ways that you would expect how public discourse has evolved in the last five decades. He's always had an interest in religious liberty. Even when he was a law professor at Chicago in the 1960s, he would write articles and deliver papers on religious liberty. It makes sense. He came from a deeply religious background. He wanted to understand the boundaries between religious organizations and legal freedoms and federal control. That has always been a hallmark of his interest. But then in the 1970s and 1980s, as he becomes president of BYU, as he serves on Utah's Supreme Court, as then he becomes an apostle, he recognized this conservative judicial movement in America that is often framed around religious values and morals. Mm-hmm. And that at first, religious liberty means that these religious groups have the rights to help shape public discourse, including things like same-sex marriage or equal rights, that it is within a religious group's rights to speak out and try to push measures that they believe match their priorities and interests and morals. Now, this then evolves, of course, in the last decade as, say, same-sex marriage becomes the law of the land. Now, religious liberty adopts accordingly. Now, you see him speaking about religious liberty in terms of we need to carve out exemptions for religious groups so that even while we can no longer shape society on these values, we've lost that war. We need to be able to have the right to protect our own boundaries so that we don't have to accept gay marriage. Or most recently, they filed an amicus brief with a court case over whether transgendered individuals should be a protective class, which is another example of the church emphasizing that religious liberty means that we should be able to carve out enough space to frame our own boundaries and practice that is not trampled upon what the federal government and the nation is doing.
So is that all he means by religious liberty? One of the things you say is that he wielded religious liberty in defense of the actions of churches to use their religious language to set their own rules about things like same-sex marriage. So it makes me wonder, does his concern for religious liberty only apply to his concerns about, you know, the progression of LGBTQ rights and the possibility, you know, their possible incursion into the rights of religious groups? Or was there some other broader, like, constitutional idea that he has in mind? Or is it just about that?
Yeah. So I think there is a broader constitutional model. He has always expressed a reservation on judicial and federal overreach into private life. In fact, he said some remarks about how, you know, the civil rights movement would have evolved differently had it been legislatures who solved it rather than the Supreme Court, you know, with Brown v. Board of Education, which a lot of historians are a bit skeptical of those claims that sometimes it took the outside intervention, otherwise the rights of these minority groups would be trampled upon. So I think there is a broader judicial philosophy of Oakes, but it often is the rights of LGBTQ minorities, the boundaries of the definition of marriage that have been the animating focus for Oakes in the last few decades.
Because it gets to the question, I think, Professor, about Oakes' ideology and his worldview. Because he sounds to me like a Burkean conservative. Respect for tradition and institutions, skeptical of radical change, a belief in moderation and prudence. Is that right?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great way to put it. He's a Burkean conservative. I mean, you can actually see that in that 1968 essay with which we began this discussion. He writes quite eloquently and persuasively, I acknowledge all the systematic wrongs that have been done in the nation, that there is systematic racism baked into American history, and that we need to overcome that, that we've had some points of progress in the last decade, more than in the decades leading up to it, but and we have more to do. But, and then there's always this Burkean but to do that further change, we need to do so in an orderly, strategic, slow process. We can't tear down the institution. We need to work within the institution. And just like he sees the LDS institution, one that needs to follow precedent and maintain those boundaries, so too, for a long time, did he see American society as working that way as well. Hmm. That if we lose our foundations, we're not going to be turning to improving the lives of the marginalized citizens. We're going to fall into chaos, and then we're not going to be able to take care of anyone.
Your colleague, the scholar Patrick Mason, said that he describes it as the Oaks doctrine, which is on contested issues, we should seek to moderate and then unify.
Yeah, I would. I'm rare to disagree with Patrick in general. I try to plagiarize all of his ideas that I can. No, but I think he's absolutely right there. And in general, that's an approach that works well within church leadership. I think one reason he has been so consequential as an apostle in the last 40 years is he is very good at forming a consensus and bringing people over to his side and not coming off as a radical. I think that's why that we're going to be able to see his presidency as a continuation of what's come to before, because he's already built the groundwork for where the church might go to from here.
So he's described sometimes as doctrinaire, but what you're saying is don't expect someone like Ezra Taft Benson or another Latter-day Saint religious leader who was deeply conservative, a Marquis Peterson, a Boyd K. Packer. You're saying don't expect something like that, someone who is that outspoken about some of those issues.
I think Dallin H. Oaks does not fit into some of the classic categories of today. Now, he's very doctrinaire on issues like LGBTQ inclusion and gay marriage. That's clear. And I don't want to downplay that at all.
Well, we'll come to that here in a second. But yes.
But that's not the totality of his philosophy of governance and the LDS institution. I think he is much more of an institutionalist than he is a conservative. I think he views himself more as a moderate than as a doctrinaire. It just so happens that what he views as those moderate stances that preserve the institutions that he holds dear often appear doctrinaire to those pushing for progress.
All right. Let's talk about where he is on the question of LGBTQ issues. Oaks has been described as a driving force against same-sex marriage and the church's belief that homosexuality is unnatural and it's a sin. Is that right? Is he a driving force there? And how far back does that go for Dallin Oaks?
It would be hard to overstate how influential Oaks has been in crafting the LDS Church's approach to same-sex marriage. Shortly after he was called to the apostleship in 1984, he writes a memo outlining what an approach that he believes the church should follow when addressing same-sex marriage as the next major frontier. Now, we talked earlier about ambition. That's very ambitious to draft a memo for, you know, church leadership to follow on what you argue is going to be the most important issue for the church in the following decades. He argues that we need to streamline our focus instead of speaking out on all these different issues related to homosexuality, whether it be laws regarding sodomy. We need to focus on one issue, and that's same-sex marriage. And we need to define it as a moral issue, which allows us to weigh in on it rather than it being a political partisan issue. It's a moral issue. And we need to frame it around this traditional family, because if we do not act swiftly enough, we can lose the American nation in one generation, because homosexual marriages will apparently result in no one procreating. So in many ways, that memo reflected a lot of the culture war issues of conservative judicial mind of Republicans during the 1970s and 1980s, now framed in a religious language that can be adopted. And one can say that the LDS Church followed that approach he outlined in that memo to a T until the Obergefell decision in 2015 entered in a new era.
So do you think he still believes that same-sex marriages are going to decimate traditional marriages? Or is he, as far as you can tell or discern from what he says publicly, and sometimes this can be hard, has he evolved in any way on any of that, as far as you can tell?
This is going to sound maybe unpopular to some who want to, you know, cast Dallin H. Hooks in stone who never changes. But I do think he has evolved in this. Now, probably not as far as many would like to see, but I look at an address that he delivered at University of Virginia in 2021, where he talked about religious freedom and non-discrimination, kind of giving an update on where America now stands on LGBTQ rights and gay marriage. And in that address, where he does talk about carving out religious exemptions for churches, like we've discussed already, he acknowledges that gay couples deserve these rights, that they have suffered, that they have proved worthy of those privileges of citizenship, and giving a lot more concessions in that speech than I've seen Oaks in other venues. Now, maybe that's pragmatism, realizing the writing on the wall. I mean, a vast majority of young Latter-day Saints now support gay marriage. So if you're going to maintain your opposition to gay marriage, you may lose a generation of the church, just not in the way that you assumed before. So maybe pragmatism, it may be evolution. He has a grandson who leads the Utah Ballet, who's come out as queer and has spoken about what it's like having his grandfather being Dallin H. Hooks. So like many Americans, he's probably had to soften as a result of familial relationships and just the changing time. So I think there are some through lines in Dallin H. Hooks's views on this, but I think it would be wrong to assume he hasn't evolved at least a little on the topic.
It makes me wonder what will happen, the way the church may move on this issue. And here's what I mean by that. I think there's some sense that the church has mostly avoided the subject lately in terms of finding some kind of definitive statement or resolution. I mean, beyond saying, yes, this is our doctrine. But it seems like there's been some kind of permissiveness on the way, on the treatment of same-sex couples, more gentle language, I think some would argue, some would say absolutely not, but there seems to be some sense of that. And there seems to be also some idea that the issue is just kind of sitting there right now, and church leaders are unsure what to do next. I guess I'll ask, what do you think about that? And what do you think Dallin Hooks thinks about that? Will there be any movement under his administration?
If anything, I think that the November 2015 policies that were introduced that cast those in same-sex marriage as in apostasy and denying their children from salvific ordinances and ordinations, that was the third rail that kind of taught them where the boundaries is, because there was such a vehement backlash against those policies and outrage, because nearly every LDS family in America now is connected in some way to someone who identifies as queer, who is in a queer relationship. And so that was seen as moving way too far, which is why they then walked it back a few years later and have not revisited that topic since then. I think they recognize there's often this, you got me on a rant here, Doug, I apologize. There's often this assumption that Latter-day Saint leaders will say jump and every Latter-day Saint will ask how high. Yeah. That they will immediately click into formation when church leaders tell them something. Church authority doesn't operate that way in Mormon history. Church leaders are able to wield such authority because they are able to determine where the society is, where LDS society is at that moment. And they know within that spectrum what they can do. That's why they don't push measures that will get massive pushback. And when they do, there is pushback, and that they have to relent to be able to get back into that sweet spot of governing. And I think they recognize that with same-sex marriage right now, that this is a topic that they're going to lose, that the writing is on the wall and it's not going to be reversed. Young Latter-day Saints support gay marriage to a degree that cannot be turned back. Now, where the church has doubled down on, of course, is on transgender issues.
Yeah.
It almost seems like they're taking their energy that used to be solely on same-sex marriage issues, and now they're just kind of leaving that in stasis because they're in this very awkward position to where they're acknowledging the inborn status of homosexuality, that you can be born with those inclinations. We're just not going to allow you to act on it. That's a very awkward position to be in, and I don't know how sustainable it's going to be in the long term, but right now they're just kind of sitting in that awkwardness. But at the same time, they can double down on transgender issues because they feel that there is a clear cultural war on that front that they can still win.
Hmm. That means they're being tossed by public sentiment, does it not?
Yeah. Yeah, I know that the Latter-day Saint Church prides itself on not swaying with every wind of doctrine, that remaining this constant truth throughout centuries. But in reality, the LDS Church has to evolve, just like any organization. Otherwise, they leave their followers. That's been one of the keys to the Latter-day Saint Church's success and growth, because they have been able to adapt even while maintaining these appeals to transcendence.
Benjamin Park. He's an associate professor of history at Sam Houston State University. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're asking what we can expect from the new president of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Dallin H. Oaks was ordained as the faith's new prophet and president on Tuesday. We have with us today the historian and scholar Benjamin Park. President Oaks has said the faith is a family-centered church. Seems like there's a lot there in that. What does he mean when he says that? And what is his focus, his apparent focus anyway, on family going to mean for his administration?
In many ways, this fits into that same post-pioneer mindset that I had been discussing before, of this generation that Oaks and Nelson were part of that is somewhat divorced from those who were their predecessors. Dallin Oaks was raised in a church in which the traditional family was placed as the core of the gospel, as the center of practice. The church adopted that, like many American conservative groups, in the wake of World War II, as a new pillar on which American society will be built. Now, notably, they then create this mythic idea of a traditional family that they believe has always been the bedrock of society, but it never was. It was a modern creation, just like anything else. But it then becomes sacralized, so that when the Proclamation of the Family is issued in 1995, while Dallin H. Oaks was a member of the Quorum of the Twelve, and according to his own narrative, he was part of the committee that helped draft the Proclamation on the Family, that proclamation was the culmination of several decades of movement towards seeing the nuclear family as the core of the gospel. Now, the problem is there are inherent tensions with that focus and modern society, that people don't live in those traditional family units anymore, that those traditional gender norms are no longer embraced by a majority of society. I mean, they never fully were, but they're especially and flagrantly moved away from today. And so when they focus on a family-centered church, there are many Latter-day Saints who do not see their own experience reflected in that ideal. A majority of Latter-day Saints now don't live in one of those traditional families, but that's only caused the church leaders, including Dallin H. Oaks, to double down on an ideal that never was a reality and certainly isn't a reality now.
Hmm. You've written about when Oaks was first in the Quorum of the Twelve, that he was involved in this, I guess you could call it a crackdown on some of the extremism from the far right that was playing out among some members of the church. Say a little bit about that. And I wanted you to sort of talk about that in the context of something we've been hearing, that Dallin Oaks is still concerned about political extremism in the church and a kind of resurgence of it almost today.
We often think back to the cultural battles within the church in the 1980s and 1990s, and we only remember those liberal progressive components of those who were excommunicated and disciplined. But there was a right-wing extremism within the church that caused a lot of consternation and headaches. Bo Greitz was a figure that might sound familiar to some audiences, but there are these groups that would eventually culminate in groups like the Bundys, Ammon and Bundy and his father, who represented taking the church on a far-right extremism, not believing the church is doing enough to fight these cultural and political battles. And Dallin H. Oaks, remember, as an institutionalist, he does not feel comfortable with these populist extremism, whether on the right or the left. And so as an institutionalist, he is as worried about these groups that are challenging the church, society, the world, civilization, that are trying to tear down these foundational values and institutions, which is why, I mean, I don't know his personal politics, but from the outside, looking at his history, he's probably more of a Mitt Romney Republican than he is a Mike Lee Republican, because he wants to value that tradition and that traditional conservatism rather than the anti-institutional populist conservatism. And we've gotten some hints to that. We've seen in recent years him speak out after the January 2021 insurrection on the Capitol, saying Latter-day Saints should abide by electoral results. We've seen during the George Floyd summer of 2020 him speak at Brigham Young University and saying Black Lives Matter is a suitable slogan. All of those are examples of what he sees as institutional reforms. Him being an institutionalist does not mean he's against reform, does not mean that he does not see systematic problems. It's just his approach to solving those problems are always going to be found within the institution rather than outside of it.
So does that mean you think he's going to be comfortable dealing with some of these public square issues in a more sort of frontal way, and certainly more than it seemed Russell Nelson did?
Yeah, it's a good question. So first of all, I need to emphasize that historians make horrible prophets. So we never know what exactly is going to happen. But that said, I think Dallin H. Oaks, looking at this current period, he's probably as worried by this type of MAGA Christianity that's anti-institutional, disruptive, disrespectful, as much as he is worried about the progressive ills. That might be overstated. He might not be as worried about it, but he is worried about it. So the thing that I'm perhaps most interested in watching during a Dallin H. Oaks presidency, no matter how long it is how does a, in his mind, moderate-minded institutionalist operate in a society that's increasingly partisan and anti-institutional? There are very few segments of society now that are trying to hold on to traditional churches, traditional parties, traditions in general. And Dallin H. Oaks is about all of those. How is that message going to fit this present moment? I have no idea, and I'm interested in watching.
Let's talk about the first presidency that Dallin Oaks chooses. You guessed, a lot of people guessed, and I think a lot of people were wrong. It wasn't entirely surprising that he kept Henry B. Eyring in place as first counselor. But Todd Christofferson as second counselor threw a lot of people off, I guess including you, although you've said I didn't expect it, but it seems to make sense. So what do you make of the choices that he made?
Dallin H. Oaks is a man of precedent, as we've been discussing, and it's precedent to often keep the living counselors from a previous first presidency, which is why Henry B. Eyring, even though he's very aged, even though he's not in the best of health, it makes sense to maintain him in the first presidency in order to keep that continuity. D. Todd Christofferson, I think Oaks might see in Christofferson a younger him, but has a legal background, has spoken out on similar issues as Oaks. But it does make sense to now have D. Todd Christofferson in the first presidency for consistency, a counselor who can exist across several presidencies in order to serve as a bridge and, again, to maintain that precedent and continuity.
Final question. Let me ask you this finally. What do you think a presidency of Dallin Oaks is going to mean for the day-to-day lives of rank-and-file Latter-day Saints?
I think it'll mean different thing for these different Latter-day Saints. For a lot of Latter-day Saints, they likely will be very pleased at a Dallin H. Oaks presidency because he has been in their life for several decades. He was a very visual, outspoken member of the Quorum of the Twelve, and they have taken joy in seeing his ascent, seeing him as one of, you know, the great apostles who can speak to their issues. I don't think there's going to be a lot changing in their worship services and structure because a lot of those reforms have already taken place. So I think they're going to enjoy a Dallin H. Oaks presidency, even if it's not as exciting as the Russell M. Nelson presidency. But I will also note there are a lot of Latter-day Saints who may be in queer relationships. They may have homosexual siblings or children or close friends who see in Dallin H. Oaks the point of pain that has brought a lot of crisis for them over the years. And it's probably going to be a lot different because one of the underestimated elements of someone becoming LDS president is in Latter-day Saint culture. That means not only everything he says from this day is considered the words of the prophet, it means everything he said before this point is also the words of a prophet. It's kind of this retroactive blanket of the prophet impromptu over all his actions in the past, which is going to be a bit difficult for some Latter-day Saints.
Benjamin Park, thank you very much.
It's a privilege.
Benjamin Park. He's an associate professor of history at Sam Houston State University. He's author of the book American Zion, A New History of Mormonism. You can check out his YouTube page for history and politics and Mormonism. It's Benjamin Park Historian. We have a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West, or you can email us at radiowest@KUER.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.